heard an interesting voice.
Ah, I see.
All right, I'll go ahead and call to order for the regularly scheduled Board of Supervisors meeting on April 26th. If the audience will join the board in the pledge of allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
First thing on our agenda is the public comment number one. This comment period is for the public to address topics on today's agenda. We are having a public hearing on the potential paving of 600th Avenue. If anybody would like to speak to that, we can wait, and you can speak during the public hearing if you'd like. If not, feel free to come up now. And anybody move to the mic? Agency reports, Mid-Iowa Community Action, Earlene McAtee and Sunny Thompson. Good morning.
I'm Arlene McAtee. I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Iowa Community Action, and I have Sunny Thompson with us. She's our Story County Family Development Director. Gloria Simons, who usually accompanies us, is our Health Service Director, isn't able to be here today. Michael was awarded a CDC National WIC Association demonstration grant on infrastructure building. We're using that grant to track what's going on with the MCO conversion and to keep track of what's going on with families and services and providers in that area. And they're at a training today on that topic. So I will therefore be talking about the agency in general and a little bit about the health services, and then Sunny will talk about our family development services. And let me thank you for your ongoing support. It's been crucial in this time. The environment, I know you're doing this everywhere and you experience it too, is one where, you know, resources are not growing, with the exception of two programs. We really haven't seen any increases in funding in the last several years. That's a challenge which we have the staff to meet. At the same time that we don't experience any increase in our resources in many areas, we did experience an increase in our asset funding, particularly for our dental clinic. So that is extremely valuable in this environment. We did do a survey in the last few months, beginning in about January and finishing up in March, of people that we served. We've talked about that before. We tried to do that fairly often, and we had a survey of 225 of the low-income folks that we serve in our five-county area, and that told us a couple of things that I think will be important to remember as we talk about this report. The first thing that came through is the vast majority of the people that we're serving are working. They have employment as their income. So way over 60% are either working or have unemployment, which means that they were working and are continuing to look for work. The second largest group would be people who are receiving Social Security or pensions. So we're talking about retired. And then the next group would be folks who are receiving disability assistance. It's important then to remember that there's also working families. You'll see when we look at some of our statistics that there are a number of children as well as adults who are served by Mid-Iowa Community Action. And one last fact is while these adults and households are working, they are not earning enough to lift themselves out of poverty, because the majority of families we serve had incomes at or below 100% of the poverty level, which means approximately $23,000 for a family of four. So we have a lot of folks who are working in our area, but they can't get enough hours or they can't get a high enough wage to allow themselves to be lifted out of poverty. So that takes Mike in a couple of directions. One is, we know these incomes put people at risk of having things not being met by their family. So we're here to meet those, to fill those gaps of basic needs and work in the areas of nutrition, housing, utilities, all of those sort of basic areas of life that people need assistance with. The second thing, though, is we know that people need to be thinking about what other opportunities might be out there for them. So we also offer developmental assistance to help them to get their skill sets and their knowledge and their resources put together so that they might think about other ways that they could move up the ladder to a higher socioeconomic level. So I'm going to talk for just a brief moment. You have a written report that you received on our health services. And on the front page, you see some data from the Story County Dental Clinic. What we are able to show you are what our appointments have been like since October 1st and through March 31st. And you can see that we had 1,653 appointments during that period, and 288 of those were new patients who came through our doors. It's over 60% of the people we serve at the dental clinic are Story County residents, but not quite 40% come from other areas, particularly Boone County and Fort Dodge. Those are two of the highest areas that we have people attending our dental clinic. The environment for operating the dental clinic is challenging. Since November last year, we've been working very hard to restructure a lot of things in the clinic to prepare it for both higher levels of production and for a new environment that is probably on the horizon, with the MCO is probably taking over dental in the not-too-distant future. So we restructured staff, we put new protocols into place, we're using new scheduling, but this will be a crucial year for us to determine, can the dental clinic produce enough revenue that we can have a reasonable level of support from the community and continue the clinic? And we are in the process of investigating that over the course of this fiscal year. And you can see also from that page that we're serving people from all age groups at the dental clinic, from little children on up to seniors. We also have the following services in Story County, and you can see statistics as to the number of people we serve with the Women, Infants, and Children's Special Nutrition Program, with over 1,000 persons a month from Story County are served by that program. Our maternal and child health services, which act as a linchpin to help people look holistically at the health needs of their children and for pregnant women. And you can see that we've served 2,046 children since October and 58 women, pregnant women. We have First Five, which is a unique program. It's considered a model in the nation, Iowa's First Five programming. It's a mechanism whereby doctors who do assessments of children and feel that there's some kind of an issue that needs follow-up care can refer them to our First Five case managers. Those case managers then will see that family through whatever other resources and referrals need to be made and make sure that any barriers like transportation, being able to access insurance, and all those sorts of things are taken care of in the process. We have a child care nurse consultant. That person works with daycare providers to make sure that the environments are safe and healthy, and also can provide trainings to those providers. And we've worked with 43 child care providers since October. We have the School Sealant Project, which is fairly new to Story County. We're working with three elementary buildings. We can go in twice a year and provide sealants on the teeth of third graders to make sure that they're protected from future decay. And we had a variety of students who were served through that. And then the breastfeeding peer counseling program, which assists women who want to breastfeed with mentors who can help them through that process. So that's our health report. Sunny will now talk to you about family development.
Thank you, guys, first of all. We have been extremely busy this year on the family development side. Since the beginning of 2016, you have the numbers in front of you, but I just wanted to share that our food pantry numbers have been up January, February, and March from last year's numbers significantly. And then I pulled numbers before I came in this morning, and it looks like for April we're going to see an increase again. Each month we've seen an average of 20 to 30 new families coming in to utilize the pantry. As Arlene was saying, we have both the emergency needs, but then the other thing that we're doing for the community is the family development. All of our family development programs have been very successful. Our Steps to Success, which is partially funded through ASSET, has had a waiting list for the last couple of years. The families in that program, when they've exited through the assessments that we're using through the LSP, are showing that their income levels have increased, that they've increased their resources. that, as Arlene was saying, you know, 90% of them in that program are working. You know, it is making a difference in the community, so we greatly appreciate the support that you guys provide to us. And, you know, we also have our early childhood programs. The early Head Start program here in Story County is very successful. Our Head Start program here in Nevada, we changed that to an all-day program this year, and that has remained full all year, so that's been a great transition. And then we are wrapping up our energy assistance program. That ends this month at the end of the week, and then we will go into full effective crisis mode where we're helping those families that are at the disconnect level. So extremely busy in family development.
Any questions? None for me. Thank you.
No, not so much questions, just again a comment, and mainly for the benefit of the audience. You know, Story County being one of the larger counties in the service area for MICA, one of us supervisors have served on the MICA board for many years. Former supervisor Halberton served for well over 15, 16 years more. And then when I came on board, I think it was now 2004 or 2005, I believe, I served on the MICA board representing Story County. And last year, of course, Paul Field came to lead. So I'm finishing up my term, but I'd like to just to really, again, acknowledge the outstanding job that Arlene and her staff does. Some years ago when we were doing some of our strategic planning, one of the key things that struck me was in the mission statement and the overall philosophy is that MICA is about helping individuals be able to have a hand up. Rather than a handout. We're giving them the skill set to make a more positive growth for the future, and whether we're talking about impacting children or families, it has really been a joy for me personally to just see how the staff engages with the clients that we serve, not just in Story County, but with our entire region. And as Arlene has said, we've been looked upon nationally as a model in this particular area. And I just wanted to personally say that after, you know, my term is up at the end of this year, I'm certainly going to miss the great staff and opportunities working with you guys. But I know that with your leadership and your staff, they're going to continue to serve me for the folks in our region. So just wanted to put a plug and say a special thank you for all you guys have done.
Well, and thank you for your service on our board, Wayne. It's been very valuable, and we'll miss you.
Thank you very much. Next is the Veterans Affairs Quarterly Report, Brett McClain. Morning, Brett.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
It's Brett, everybody. I haven't been here for a while, so I have a really long report. No, not really.
Well, we'll cut it short.
No, it's not too bad. All right. First thing I want to talk about, this will be, of course, it'll be January through March, is our county veteran benefits, and then I'll go into state and federal, kind of where I've been working in those areas. One thing I want to mention is a vision that we have, is to ensure that Story County veterans receive timely access to highly qualified benefits and services I can provide, and which they've earned through their sacrifice and service to our nation. So that's kind of my day-to-day vision. Had two veterans come in for utility assistance, actually three. One was for LP, $307.79 for the utilities, and then the LP was $120. Our budget this year for that is $1,500, and I spent $1,211. So we're doing pretty good there. Two veterans came in for rent assistance, $734.98. Budget this year is $10,005, and we've only had to use $1,729. One veteran family came in for burial assistance. That was $1,840. Our budget this year for that is $5,000, and unfortunately I've had to use $11,000 so far this fiscal year. Total for the county assistance was $3,002.77 for six veterans. Now, to move into interviews that I've had for state and federal benefits, and I want to give you some war dates here when these folks served. I've seen 61 World War II veterans, some for the first time, just checking their benefits now. Anyway, these folks served between December 7th, 1941, to December 31st, 1946.
Interesting, it's December 7th, isn't it? That is the right date?
Yep. Seen 22 that served during Korea, which those dates were June 25th, 1950 to January 31st, 1955. And almost the same as World War II is in the Vietnam era, 63, January or February 28th of 61 to May 7th of 75. And, you know, in this group, it's interesting with World War II in Korea. It didn't matter where you served at. You was a World War II and a Korea veteran. But when we came to Vietnam, we had a little break there. We either had in-country veterans or we had era veterans. And so in that group of Vietnam, there was some era there. Persian Gulf, 17 there. Of course, Persian Gulf started August 2nd, 1990, and it's still open. Seen 18 for peacetime, Cold War, during, in between all these different wars that we were in. And then 19 for OIF, OEF, and OND. Here's where it gets a little confusing. OIF is people that served in Iraq from March 20th, 2003 to August 30th, 2010. And then OEF is Afghanistan, which is October 7th, 2001 to present. And then OND, Operation New Dawn, is people that served in Iraq since August 31st of 2010. 44 surviving spouses, and that was a total of 245 interviews for the quarter, or roughly 81 per month.
Brett, some of the new people that you just mentioned for the first time, in your contact, did any of them speak of hearing about it through, you know, your freedom flights and other things and the publicity that we've had over the last several years? I'm just kind of curious a little bit. Gentlemen, I know you've got a lot of outreach and we've had this different
Well, it's interesting because we've actually had an office in the county somewhere between 35 and 40 years. You know, so we've had somebody here. Outreach is how we really find these folks. And a lot of them, for the first time, will file benefits because we had a supermarket. Or the April 1st of, we had the DAV was here. It's a mobile office, and they did claims. On one side of the parking lot, we hand out furniture on the other side of the parking lot. So I'm not sure what got them there, the furniture or doing the claims. We did both those things. So, yeah, that's a real key piece is to outreach to veterans. A lot of them need a little bit of a nudge to come in and to get benefits. I heard this morning, Wayne, it's not a hand out, but it's a hand up. Almost the same thing here. A lot of Iowans are proud and a lot of veterans are proud. And maybe that's why I'm just now seeing some of the World War II veterans for the first time. Some upcoming events that we have is one is the probably the best outreach that I can do is it's called the Story County Veterans Newsletter, and so that is as we speak. Actually, we okayed the draft today, and it's going to printing. So that's going to be going out in May. We want to go out prior to the Veterans Appreciation Day, which is going to be held at the Bandshell Park from 11 to 2. We have food, entertainment, free haircuts, veterans resources and services. Again, that's May 11th, which is a Wednesday. This was kind of, Paul, remember we were talking about homeless stand-downs? This is kind of what we moved to last year in place of the homeless stand-down, just based on the numbers. We just didn't have the numbers that we needed. At this event, we're able to take care of whether they're a homeless veteran or not a homeless veteran. Doesn't matter. We're going to be able to take care of them for both. And the haircuts aren't going to be like, boot camp haircuts or anything. We've actually got beauticians that are coming. I'm a little worried when they see that haircut thing in there. And of course, the day before that, I'm going to have a booth at the Expo, which is 9 to 5 at the Quality Inn in Ames, the Seniors Expo. So, Wayne, you're probably eligible to attend anything. So it's a real good event. I mean, this thing has really grown. Actually, I called the other day to see if they had any more space for other tables, and they're pretty much maxed out. So outreach that we've had in the last quarter wasn't too much during the winter, but April 1st we did have the DAV was up here, and then pretty much every Friday in the last quarter, I'm at nursing home and assisted living. And kind of what it's looking like, I've got more people on my schedule than I can even see. So then they roll to the next Friday. So that's pretty much the norm for me anyway, in order to go out and see the folks that can't come in and see me. On the newsletter, give you a few numbers. The total is 3,817 that we're going to be sending out. 3,203 will be mailed. And 603 will be emailed. And I'm kind of working towards maybe reducing what we mail and increase what we email. So that's a pretty good number, really, for just starting this thing off that way. And then I've got 11 that'll be sent over to the Iowa Veterans Home. And I'm going to get like 100 just flat ones, but we're not going to mail. We're just going to have in the office to pick up in case anybody didn't get one. So 3,817, and that's some good outreach right there, because it's a six-pager. Our flyer will be in there about our event on May 11th. So working on that. Mainly during the year, I'm doing two big events, and that's the Veterans Appreciation Day in May, and in November, the supermarket. Continue doing both those things. Pretty much the same groups come into both. We've got a little bit more on the ones in the outside venue and ones inside. Is about the difference there. But also we have a commissioner opening that's posted for the required 90 days. It'll close May 31st at 5 p.m. So if anybody's interested in being a commissioner, we have that on our, I believe it's on our homepage on the website.
Requirements, real quick. We're being a commissioner.
We're looking for a, of course, you got to be a military veteran. You have to live in the county. We've had some in the past that applied that didn't live in the county. You have to live here in the county. Serve honorably. And then once you get appointed, and then we kind of start the training. So, no training required. We're looking to be gender balanced. It's on the agenda for the next commission meeting, which is May 5th, whether to add two seats to the board or not. We may have a few more openings if the commission wants to do that, and if the board of supervisors wants to do that. So. Yeah, and the other thing we've tried to do is balance out the wartime era and where they live at, too. We don't want three commissioners living in Ames. We kind of want them. And so right now we have one in Ames, one in Story City, and one in Colo. And we've never, that I could find, we've never had one south of Highway 30. So... We meet once, you know, once a month, and in between meetings they're in their communities, at coffee shops, wherever, and referring veterans to the office. And what they do. And one other on that note, you know, whether we do five seats or not, out of 99 counties, there's 16 counties that do have five commissioners. And out of those counties, four of them are home-based counties. So, that's all I have, Warden. You have anything for me?
How's the office space?
Good. Doing good. Jen, Melanie, and Wendy's helped me a lot with Willis newsletter, the database, all the administrative things like that, and helped me with appointments and doing some meet and greet when they come in and doing some paperwork, you know, in the lobby. So, yeah, everything's working good.
Outstanding.
I think I had one person in the whole time that went to the wrong office,
mm-hmm.
but otherwise everybody, you know, seen my five signs that I put up. So. But anyway, you know, it's working out pretty good.
All right.
Thanks.
Good. Next is consideration of minutes from April 19th.
Move approval.
Second. On a motion and a second, are there any additions or corrections? Clinton?
Aye.
Sanders?
Aye.
Two? Aye. Has been approved. Consideration of personnel actions. Move approval.
Second.
On a motion and a second. Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Two. Aye. Consent agenda. Gentlemen, add road closures 1656 and 1657 and utility permits 1660, 61, 62.
Move approval with noted changes.
Second. Got a motion and a second to approve the consent agenda. Is there anything further? Clinton.
Aye.
Sanders.
Aye.
Two. Aye. That takes us to a public hearing to receive comments on the proposed paving of 600th Avenue from Highway 30 north 1 mile to Lincoln Highway. Darren Moon, County Engineer. Good morning, Darren.
Good morning. I'm here to hold a hearing on 600th Avenue paving, similar to the grant loan we did a few weeks ago. For two reasons. One, to meet a DOT requirement for paving points, which I'll get to. And another reason is just to have a good discussion with the public before this project is too far along for some public input. Currently, we added it to FY17. That means our goal is to get this designed and then constructed next calendar year. This will be paid for with farm to market funding, which means we have to go through the DOT letting process. And to meet their time frame, we probably need to have this designed and right away purchased by August in order to get it in for a winter letting. And then we need about an additional $100,000. We don't know that exact amount yet until we get the right-of-way needs established and then get some land values established also to purchase the right-of-way. We're already had the road surveyed, and we're about halfway through the design process. I'll be bringing final plans at some point back to the board for final approval before we start buying right-of-way. Like I mentioned, the purpose for the hearing is we did not quite meet the 50 paving point requirement the DOT has. And if you don't meet the 50, you just need to hold a hearing and get some public input on the project before you proceed. We had 46 points out of the possible. This is how they're calculated. Under number one, we just made this a farm to market road a few years back. So we did get the 20 points for farm to market with both termini at a city, major collector, a higher system. Number two, the ADT, the current DOT counts are 110, so we only got 11 points for the ADT on number two. The closest parallel route is 1 mile, so we got 0 points for number three. Number four, we did put the full 15 possible points for the trucks, because we know that road gets a lot of truck traffic. That gave us a total of 46 points and did not quite meet the 50. We could have possibly argued the ADT is higher than that, but it's easier just to hold the hearing and get some public input at the same time. This is that 1 mile stretch of road, Highway 30 on the bottom, and at the top is Lincoln Highway. Pretty straightforward project. The only thing we don't really know yet is the actual layout of the Highway 30 design at the bottom, so there could be a portion, if there's an overpass here, that could get removed in the future when the DOT comes in to put the interchange in this area. This is the only area that gets a little tight through the front yard there, and there's some large trees you can see the shadows of. And talking with Nancy a little earlier, it might not be big of an issue. Getting right away, they might not mind those trees being gone, so that's good to hear. Because when we do, when we pave a road, we have to bring it up to a paving standard. And what that does, a lot of areas have to be raised up, deeper ditches, and it just pushes everything out. That's average on this road might be additional 15 feet of right-of-way on each side. We're getting real close to finalizing the design, so we'll know pretty soon how much that'll actually be. But in general, that'd be a fairly easy design. And last step, we have to pass a resolution. It won't be at next week because there isn't a full board meeting next week, but the week after I'll have a resolution on the consent agenda, and I'll put in there to the DOT who is in favor and who's against the project as part of that resolution. So if there are people here in favor or against, I recommend to just come up for a quick comment so I can get some comments to send to the DOT on this.
Before you're done, Darren, you mentioned the possibility of DOT coming in and putting in an overpass or even an interchange here. Where is that imminent in your mind? Where does that stand?
I don't know. Paul might know a little bit more from the meetings on where that stands. That's the latest I heard. Is the latest design is an interchange at 600 and then some frontage roads. On the north side of Highway 30.
But not in any kind of program. So nothing imminent. As soon as it would be 10 or 15 years, right?
Well, they took the money for the Nevada improvements out of the five-year plan because they couldn't come up with a decision on what they wanted.
And then the task force was formed. We've met three times. We were told, I think in March, by Scott Dockstetter, who's our lead engineer, that the money had been taken out. He said, and for all practical purposes, you wouldn't see anything else done in this corridor until 2023 at the earliest. So, and when you talk about the corridor, 600 is not at the top of their list, right? The corridor, the Nevada interchange, and 580 would be the two that they would tackle first. And so for me, it's just... and I think you're going to read this in. We got an email questioning whether we were doing this as part of the possibility there being an interchange there.
Right.
I'm not looking at that ever happening, or if it does happen, it'd be sometime in a much later date. It would have nothing to do with this project.
Right. Yeah, I'll make the comments that we received during the public hearing.
Okay. Okay.
Anything else for Darren? Okay, with that, I'll open the public hearing. If anybody wants to speak on this proposed project, this would be the time. I'd invite you to come up here to the microphone and state your name and tell us what you think. Not seeing a huge rush. I'll read in, not entirely in its total, but into the record, email that we all received from Murray McConnell. Murray's family owns the farmstead on the northeast corner of Highway 30 and 600 Avenue. They've owned that farmstead since 1897. His father, John, was born there 87 years ago and still lives there with Murray's sister, Terry, and her husband are in the back here. Murray has urged the board not to approve the paving if it is a step in the process that would put an interchange at that intersection and eliminate the farmstead. The only thing I'll add is that it is not a step in that process. We're taking this step because the process broke down at some point when the city of Nevada rejected the DOT's plans. We knew that when that plan was rejected and the money was taken out of this corridor, that in all likelihood the truck traffic would increase greatly on 600th Avenue. It's been our understanding that that's going to be the preferred route to get to the two ethanol plants. For whatever reason, apparently the truck drivers don't like to make right-hand turn from 580th to go east on Lincoln Way at the apartment building near where the old church was, church and school. They don't like that corner, so it's apparent that the truck traffic is going to prefer 600th Avenue. So, if the DOT was going to put an interchange up there, for sure, I would sit back and let the DOT pave that road and not have Story County have to pay for it. But like the DOT has told us, in all likelihood, we won't see anything at all in that corridor until 2023. The plan that this task force approved was a plan that was designed by the city's engineer and not the Department of Transportation. There's no guarantee that the Department of Transportation will approve that plan. And 6 or 7 years from now, who knows who's going to be on the Nevada City Council and whether they're going to like the plan at that point. I think the plan they approved this time was a plan that was initially designed in 1993. So they've gone back to the initial plan. So I don't think the county could sit and wait and see what the DOT was going to do. It's obvious they're not going to do anything for several years. There's going to be an increased amount of truck traffic on that road, and I think the county needs to take the action and pave that road.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask, Darren made reference to our engineer, the resolution that would need to be submitted if we move forward, and in that resolution there is a need to respond to those who are in favor and those who are against. Would it be appropriate, even though we have not heard from a lot of people other than this one, to just kind of get a show of hands for the people that are in the audience that are in favor or against, so that at least Darren has a feel for, you know, where we stand in that process. So I just...
Sure. Yeah, if nobody else would like to speak, I would just ask that anybody that is in favor of this paving project, keep in mind it's simply paving the highway. It's got nothing to do with the possibility of an interchange at some point in the future. But if you are in favor of paving that stretch of road on 600th Avenue, if you raise your hand.
I don't know how you operate when speaking.
Yeah, come on up. Come on up.
Please come up.
If you want to see what the...
No, please, I just... So this is recorded.
If you want to see what the trucks do to the road, I live on that road. My name's Jim Friel. And north of Jim Miller's, they've got it pushed up the height.
Yep.
It needs, if you're going to pave it, it needs to be thick, and you need to put footing drains in it to get rid of the water. But today would be a good day, because I counted before I came in here, there were 73 vehicles on that road.
Yep. Little history on this road, and Darren, you correct me if I misstate anything here. This was in the five-year calendar for the county 10 years ago to be paved. It was not a farm to market road at that point. We came in, and the three of us worked with Darren to turn that stretch into a farm to market road 5 years ago, Darren, thereabouts, with the intention of recognition that traffic, and particularly truck traffic, was growing on that road. But then we took a wait-and-see approach while DOT and Nevada was working through what this corridor was going to look like. Once it became apparent that DOT is not going to do anything along that stretch, I think that's what put it back in front of us as needing to do something, with the recognition that the truck traffic out there is just going to grow. As DuPont gets operational and everything goes, it's just going to grow, and it's time to get this done, in my view. Okay, so that'll take us back to the show of hands in favor. Okay. And then opposed. Okay. If there's nobody else that wants to speak, I'll close the public hearing, and this requires no action from the board. So,
and this comes to us again next week.
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry.
You only come lately. Good to see your name for us.
My name is Jim Miller. I live on the middle of 600th Avenue there. It's kind of funny. Paul had up there for a picture of the homestead of the trees is my place. Those trees, I would assume, we lived there for 42 years now. Those trees, I think, are over 100 years old. They're hollow. They're all rotted out inside. I'm always afraid of an east wind blowing over because the high line's out to the east side of the road, west side of the road. So we lost those trees. We don't care. High semi-traffic, yes, it's very heavy. Being on the east side of the road with a west wind most of the time, we get a lot of dust. Can't even see out there. We're totally in favor of it. My only request is when are we going to know when it's going to start? How is it going to be done all at once, or the north half and then the south half, or the east side and the west side, so I can make plans how I'm going to get out of there if I have, you know. We're both retired, so about once a week we may go to town, buy some milk or something. It's not like a daily, you know, deal, but...
Yeah, and so, Jim, I believe our answer to that is we need to get the final plan before we start into a timeline. But a general timeline is if we can have all the preliminary work done so that we can send it to DOT with the right-of-way acquired by this August, then it would mean about this point next year is when we would be looking at doing the project. Sometime in the spring of 17 is when we'd look at doing the project. And as far as how we're going to do it, one fell swoop or half and half, that's going to be all based on what kind of plans we approve for how the road is ultimately constructed. But I think you can rest assured there will be, you won't wake up one morning and all of a sudden we're going to be out there paving. There will be lots of advance notice of exactly how we're going to make it work.
Yeah. Interesting how if the easement's going to be wider right now, it's 33 feet from the center of the road. If it's going to be wider, how that's going to affect plantings I have along the ditch. Mm-hmm. And my ditch right there is a slight hill where my place is. There's a steep ditch. It's going to be worse. We're going to be better.
Yeah, and that's all part of the design that Darren and his team are working on right now, and that will be available for public comment when you bring it to the board. Is that right, Darren?
Right.
Okay.
Yep.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I closed this hearing, didn't I, Shelley? I'll go ahead and close the hearing, unless there's anybody else. All right, I'll go ahead and close the hearing. Like I said, it's not an action item, but we will see a resolution on this next week. All right, not next week, but in the near future. Mm-hmm. All right, additional items. Discussion and consideration of Central Iowa Recovery's request of 2018 member county support for a line of credit. Deb Shildroff.
Hi, Deb.
Good morning.
Just a brief overview. Central Iowa Recovery is a provider of intensive psychiatric rehabilitation services. It's created through a 20E agreement that currently has 7 counties involved. At one point, there were 11 counties, but over the past year and a half, there have been counties who have withdrawn from that 20E agreement, so we're down to 7 counties at this point in time. There are 16 staff within Central Iowa Recovery that provide the services, and they do provide services to 13 counties, and one of those counties is Polk County. So that's kind of their service area. Central Iowa Recovery is primarily funded through Medicaid dollars, and so they have been gearing up, as everybody else has been, for the transition to the managed care organizations. Part of that transition included ending their contract with Magellan back in December, and starting a contract with Iowa Medicaid Enterprise until the MCO contracts were up in place as of April 1st. During that end of December until now time with Iowa Medicaid Enterprise, even though billing was done in a timely manner, the receipt of funds or reimbursement was slowed way down, and that was creating some cash flow issues for CIR. CIR has a contract with Central Iowa Juvenile Detention Center to be their fiscal agent and employer of record. What the detention center did for the months of March and April was allow CIR to delay paying their fee, their fiscal fee, so that they could continue meeting cash flow demands, primarily paying staff. I mean, that's their workforce. CIR is going to talk to the detention center about having the possibility of a delay in a fee again. The CIR board has urged the director, Tim Bedford, to do that. But as a backup plan, CIR has been looking at applying for a line of credit. So in the future, if there are any months where cash flow becomes an issue, they could rely on this line of credit to at least help meet payroll and other expenses. Initially, CIR came to the member counties with requesting $150,000 in line of credit. They went back and looked at their expenses. They've dropped that back down to $100,000. And there have been three counties, member counties so far, who have approved this. It would be in a resolution format. I don't have the resolution before you today because we want to know actually how many counties are going to participate before we put that into that resolution format. Three counties that have approved going forward with this are Warren, Hamilton, and Madison. Boone County has not agreed to the line of credit. However, they have agreed to assisting in some financial manner if that is needed, that they aren't supporting the line of credit methodology. Counties that are still determining this would be Story, Green, Guthrie, Audubon, which is counted as one county, and then Hardin County. Are there any questions at this point in time?
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to ask, though, we started with 11 counties in this 2080, and now we're down to 7. Give me the rationale. Who were the 4 that withdrew, and give me the rationale for their withdrawal?
Jasper County withdrew about a year and a half ago. They weren't one of the original 2080 counties. Story County wasn't one of the original counties either, but Jasper withdrew because they were hoping that there would be additional services through CIR that would be provided within their county that wasn't materializing, so they decided to withdraw from the 2080 agreement. Their county still is served by CIR. They just don't have a seat at the table as far as the 2080 agreement goes. Franklin County withdrew last fall because even though there was a presence in Franklin County, there weren't clients being served in Franklin County. That has since changed. The practitioner out of Hardin County now goes up to Franklin County and serves about 3 or 4 individuals. So even though Franklin County doesn't have a seat at the 20E table, they do continue to be served by the program. And then Marshall and Dallas are the two counties that have recently withdrew. In about the February-March time frame, Dallas just doesn't want to provide county dollars in a time that that would be needed. They don't want to fund a program in that manner. Marshall County withdrew because they felt that they'll continue to be served and they don't really have to have anybody at the table. And I think they're concerned about providing county dollars to a program that is supposed to be a Medicaid-funded program and concerned about subsidizing.
Yeah, I had exactly the same concern. I'm just curious, so short of if you're not part of the 2080 and you still receive the services, what's the advantage of being part of the 2080 other than you get to be on the hook for $15,000 in a line of credit and other considerations?
I think the benefit of continuing within the 2080 agreement is to help guide the program and to provide input into how the services should be provided and if there should be an expansion of services. This board, and this was even occurring before Story County became a member county, continually talks about moving CIR into more of a nonprofit, a 501c3 status. and away from a 20E board. That would take some time. We have received some opinions on how that should be done and the pros and cons to that. But even at our board meeting last week, as we were discussing this, because I don't think Story County is unique in expressing concerns about this. But I think in the long term, I mean, that's going to continue being a consideration of this board is to look at having this agency become a nonprofit. It could then open them up to being able to access other funding, like through United Way programs, other kinds of grants, that sort of thing. I think those are some of the more positive parts to it. I think with the NCO model just being an unknown to these agencies, if we could take a look and see approach with this, in order to, if we do approve and are part of supporting this line of credit, which a lot of nonprofits have lines of credit that they access on a regular basis, in this particular situation, the line of credit would be accessed only if the board of directors approved it, and it has to be something that's reviewed on an annual basis. The bank said that they need copies of the resolutions and showing that not only the member counties approving it, but that the CIO board approves it on an annual basis. So it's not like it's something that can be accessed at any point in time. The board has to be part of approving that.
But it's their board and not necessarily the 28E members that actually vote to determine that, which would be the board of supervisors of the member counties.
The CIR board would give approval of accessing it.
Right.
And who makes up that board?
The member counties.
Member counties. Mm-hmm. And if we don't agree...
If we don't...
agree to approve the line of credit, we give up our seat on the board.
That's how the 20...
But not the services. Not the services, but... Yeah, and we paid, what, 20, 25,000 initially?
25,000 to join. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's ironic or not, but the Central Iowa Juvenile Detention Center, like you said earlier, acts as their fiscal agent and employer of record, maintains a business line of credit themselves. And two months ago at our meeting, the director up there recommended that we vote to allow the CIR board to, we would waive their administrative fee until they could get caught up on the payments. I don't know if that would happen again. Typically what will happen is that when that board votes, if like me, this county sits on the CIO board, I would recuse myself from the vote. I don't know that board would vote again to waive that fee. So, I mean, we're into it for 20 grand. I don't know. I mean, we're on the hook for 15,000. If they borrow up to the full amount that they're capable of borrowing and they're unable to pay it back.
If all seven of the existing member counties agree,
if they continue to drop out,
if they drop out, your share goes up.
Right.
And that's part of my question, is the stipulation for when you could withdraw, and I think you would want to have a substantial number of member counties be a part of that. Otherwise, you are going to be, that cost is going to, you're going to bear the burden of that if you need to. So my part of the question, more or less, Deb, is, and maybe Paul, you're a little bit more familiar, but I'm not as thoroughly familiar with all the services that we're talking about. But when we look at determining a need and being at the table, the 2080 allows us to be at the table to, as you say, help guide and give suggestions as to how the services should be, rendered. When you look at the actual dollar amount, would it be better for us to approve it with a wait and see attitude, knowing that we could withdraw at a later date? Or I'd hate to put you on the spot, but you and Carl and folks in the community service arena, what's your overall take in terms of what is in Story County's best interest?
I think definitely we have the CIR is a one of the very few providers statewide that actually provides this service. And we don't have any other provider in Story County or within the region that's providing the service. So that's definitely a benefit, and there are definitely, you know, outcomes being tracked to the service. Last Thursday, there was a graduation ceremony, and there were 47 individuals graduating from the program. Two of them were Story County individuals, but keep in mind, Story County entered into this about 2 years ago, and it takes about 2 years to get through the entire IPR process. So, again, I think just like any other provider that's trying to set themselves up to be successful with this new managed care arena, I understand why CIR is looking for a backup plan. At this point in time, they're very timely with their billing. It's the reimbursement, the return on the reimbursement that seems to slow down. When they billed Magellan, they would be paid within less than 5 days. When they would bill IME, it was taking about 10 days. The MCOs are now saying it could take up to 2 weeks. And yet there's pressure from the state to the MCOs to allow claims to go through, and if there are issues with claims, to not necessarily hold that billing process up for those agencies. We're looking for oversight from the legislature to provide this to the MCO so we don't have these hiccups along the way. We have providers struggling. So I don't think CIR is any different than any other provider trying to get through the initial stages of this transition. What's in the best interest of Story County? The services are here. I think by having a presence on the board, it gives us a real time look at what's going on, what's working, and what might not be working. We can issue a notice to that board within 30 days of, I think it's 30 to 60 days of wanting to back out of the 20E. We can do that at any point in time. But I think CIR has shown to be a very strong agency, a leading agency with providing the service and trying to do everything they possibly can to put themselves in the best light possible to manage this transition and serve the clients that they do. We've got, besides the two individuals who graduated, we've got about 20 other individuals who are in service here in Story County with CIR and a couple on a waiting list. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That was very helpful for me.
Yeah, so we have to remember that the reason that we joined this 2080 is to make sure that we were getting these services provided here in Story County. The problem I have to have is when we kicked in the $25,000, at least my understanding of those dollars was that was in order to assist building the reserves to be able to cash flow everything while you were waiting on. Now we're saying, well, now, no, maybe the $25,000 wasn't enough. We need to have something else to be able to go to. Now, I get that this transition to the new managed care, every agency better be aware that it's going to change the way their cash flow works. So I think I tend to come down where I'm hearing Deb in this. We need to make sure that we have these services in Story County, and our best position to do that is at the table. And if being at the table means that we could be on the hook for up to another $15,000, I think I would tend to support that. But it's time for this this entity to start to look to become a standalone not-for-profit rather than a 2080 for member counties. We need these services, but they need to be able to access funds in other places than just from counties in addition to the fee-for-service model. That said, I think I would like to indicate that we view this in a positive nature, but we want to know what the other seven member counties do before we make a final commitment. And I'll put that in a motion if I need to.
Well, but if I'm hearing your motion, well, let me second the motion for discussion. Okay.
Yeah. So what I'm intending to say is that the Story County Board of Supervisors views the line of credit in a positive nature as long as we're 1/7 of that. If we're not 1/7 of that, if we're 1/4 of that, if three other counties pull out, then we're going to have the conversation again.
Right.
Okay. Right. So we're not actually approving anything. They were just lending our support. We're indicating that we'll be part of it as long as it goes as it stays as is.
It stays as is. And then if not...
Deb, is that sufficient?
Yes. And bear in mind, I mean, we've already had one county, Boone County, who does not support the line of credit methodology.
So if you don't participate in the line of credit and you lose your seat at the board, does that mean that you're no longer part of the 20E?
Correct.
Right.
Yeah. Right. The letter that came from Mr. Bedford said that should your county choose to decline to participate in this action, you are thereby withdrawing from the CIR 20E. To which we would require written notification.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that would clear up my concern, is that I wanted to be sure that at this point we weren't just declining to be a part of the process, but we were wanting to continue to monitor and see where this was going to go in the future. And as long as there is the option that we can withdraw with notice, depending upon what takes place, I would be comfortable with that.
Okay. You have a motion or a second? We've had a discussion. Shelley, are you clear on the motion? All right. Sanders?
Aye.
Clinton?
Aye.
Toot? Aye. We'll wait and see what happens.
And thank you, Deb.
Thanks, Deb. Next is discussion of housing assistance options for Crestview Trailer Court residents. Leanne Herter, Deb Schoedel, and Carla Webb. Paul, why don't we start with you as chair of the Board of Health, given the
Board of Supervisors update. How about a little history?
Yeah, that little history lesson for me and Wayne.
For the past several months, if not a couple of years, there have been some concerns about the water quality and quantity offered the residents at Crestview Mobile Home Park. For anybody that doesn't know that, Crestview lies on the Boone Story Line, west of Ames, about that far west of Ames. It's in the county nonetheless. They've been under a boil order, Margaret, since December. And they had a main water main or main water line break in the park, and the water was deemed by the DNR to be unsuitable for human consumption. And since they have more than 15 water hookups, they're considered to be a public water supply. It comes under the jurisdiction of the Department of Natural Resources. The DNR has given them several deadlines to meet. The latest one was April 15th. He was supposed to have a certified water plant operator under his employ that was going to be at the location on a daily basis to monitor the water. He didn't meet that. The Board of Health met last Tuesday. The owner of the court was there, Mr. Brant Lemire. Was part of the conversation. He was given until today, the 26th of April, to hire a certified water plant operator and to have that person on site daily to monitor the water. If he cannot meet that requirement, then the Board of Health will meet again, presumably this week, in a special meeting to issue another order giving Mr. Lemire a set number of days to cease operations at the mobile home court. He told us last week that he has 31 occupied trailers, so let's say maybe 60 people, give or take, that would be affected by this. He would like an additional 60 days because, as he says, that's the wording on his lease agreement with the trailer owners. Whether that's the case, I don't know, and that'll be up to the Board of Health to decide. But if he doesn't have a water plant operator on board by the close of business today, then it's reasonable to assume that the Board of Health will meet and issue him an order to cease providing water to those residents. So, with that...
But may I just add, but isn't it fair to say that the issue, though, has been going on for a number of years?
This particular issue really came to the forefront in December when he had the water line break. There's been there's been questions with the quality and the quantity of water. The sewer system out there is questionable at best. The entire park has issues, and the owner will admit that. He did say last week at our Board of Health meeting that it's probably in as bad a shape now as it's ever been since he's owned it. So, with that, you know, we're looking at the potential of having to force 31 homesteads to no longer be able to reside where they're at, and whether all of those people will seek assistance or some of them or none of them. But I think it's something that we need to discuss and be prepared for, because I would assume that this order is going to be issued by the Board of Health probably sometime this week. So I'll turn it over to Deb.
Right. Well, I mean, this in our discussions, I mean, this certainly dovetails on affordable housing needs. There's no question that Crestview offers that for a number of individuals. So one of the things that we've talked about are what are all the options that could be available to individuals as they seek relocation. And we have Central Iowa Housing Authority, which is the program. They're based out of Grimes, but Story County is one of their catchment counties. And they offer the Section 8 housing certificates through HUD. At a board meeting I was at last week, they said the waiting list to get a Section 8 certificate is between 6 to 12 months. Which is much better than what it had been. It had been up to 2 years at one point in time. But people can apply and be put on the waiting list for that. In the meantime, they also have a deposit program. So if individuals want to, you know, find housing in the meantime while they're waiting for their Section 8 certificate, there's a deposit assistance program of up to $700 available. Folks living in Story County. We also have agencies, many of them go through the asset process that assist with rent and utility deposits and assistance, Good Neighbors, Emergency Residence Project, the Salvation Army. We've got churches that assist with that as well, so we would have all those resources available to provide to individuals. And I had planned on, after today's meeting, to alert those entities of what could possibly be coming so they are aware of it as well. I talked to Vanessa with the City of Ames about this occurring. They have a deposit and first month rent program available, but that would be within the City of Ames proper. And then we also have our own general assistance program available through the Community Services Office that people could tap into. So with that, that's just kind of a broad brushstroke of what is available within the communities. I'll turn it over to Carla and Leanne if they have additional things to add.
I can talk a little bit about our general assistance program and how that works. We do have an application process that the individual goes through presently, and there's certain criteria that we look at in order to determine if someone is eligible. We do have a residency requirement that they need to be residing in Story County for a minimum of 6 consecutive months in an established domicile. We also have income guidelines. We've got work. We look at if they're working, if they've recently left employment within the last 90 days. Just some variables that I would want to know if we look to provide assistance through our program. Do individuals need to meet all of those requirements? Is there any leeway to waive any of that to help folks to get them moved? Currently, we do not assist with deposits. That's not something we've ever been done. Our current amounts that we assist with for families, if we're paying rent and utilities, we pay up to $550. If it's solely rent, we pay up to $500. For single individuals, rent and utilities, we pay up to $450. or 400 if it's just rent. If we are looking at just utilities for an individual and no rent assistance, our maximum is 350 towards utilities.
And that's a one-time payment of that amount, not an ongoing monthly payment.
Correct. We can assist one time in a six-month period. Do you have any particular questions about?
I may in a minute.
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead. Well, my only, I don't know if Leanne had anything to offer.
Well, Leanne has history for us because Story County has done this before.
Yes.
Right. About 15 years ago, actually this spring, Hillsdale Mobile Home Park, which is in west part of Story County as well, west of Ames, closed. That closed upon order from the DNR and issues with their wastewater system. There were 40-some units that were affected. At that point, Story County, with the assistance of Ames to put the materials together, applied for emergency CDBG funds through the state of Iowa. Plus, it's $100,000 is what we received. I think we've tried to block it out of our memory,
right.
But again, these are CDBG funds that we used. So a number of policies and I's to dot, T's to cross were applicable. We used that funding then, and Story County ran two different programs for the residents of the mobile home park. One was a relocation assistance program. So every individual in that mobile home park, every family unit, so it could be a single person as a family unit, was eligible for a certain amount, I think it was up to $25,000 or $3,000, to relocate. We had we did not have residency guidelines. We didn't have, like Carla, you have to be here 6 months or all that. It was just applicable to anyone that had their name on the list that the mobile home park owner provided to Story County. So they could use that. It could go for anything from down payment assistance. In fact, we did have one family unit buy a house. Actually, it was a really great story that came out of a really unfortunate event. First month's rent, whatever, moving assistance. Then the other program we ran was specifically for the disposal of the mobile homes. They were not roadworthy by any means. And at that point, it cost quite a significant amount to dispose of those mobile homes. They really should not be transferred in many cases. I'm speaking of that Hillsdale case. So we had a contractor come in and dispose of all those mobile homes. And that assured that we did not have then those remaining on that site to create more of a nuisance. I do have some information that there is a possibility of emergency grant funds again, but it would be very limited. And I will caution the board, though, they will be CDBG funds. So with that goes the whole gamut of policies and procedures that need to be adopted and bookkeeping and record keeping for up to 7+ years, which I'd be glad to get some more information, but I did reach out, and that is an option, but we were waiting for the second order from the board to before we officially started applying.
I would add that in my opinion, Crestview is in a similar situation that Hillsdale. Most of those mobile homes, the owner claims that he does not own them, that they are rent-to-own, most of them. I would assume that the vast majority of those 31 units aren't roadworthy, so they couldn't be transported to another mobile home park, even if there was any availability. And another thing is that and Mark, correct me if I'm wrong, but his stated intention last week to the Board of Health was to reduce the number of water hookups to 15 or fewer, removing him from the jurisdiction of the DNR and putting him under the Board of Health here in Story County, which would not alleviate the requirement to make sure that the water is clean and fit for consumption. But so we may be dealing with 16 units as opposed to 31. So,
well, and I guess I would ask again that
at no fault to the individual occupants. They are in dire straits in terms of if this is forced closure, that there needs to be some assistance somewhere. And I would hope that we would be in a position to utilize all the available resources available to assist in a situation like this. Because when we talk about affordable housing and so forth, some individuals, because of their financial situation and other factors, don't have many choices in terms of what they can afford. And I believe that we have a responsibility and an obligation to assist those that are in need within the limits of our ability. And I would just hope that in this case, regardless to what the final disposition would be, that we would be similar to the Crestview situation, that we would use all available resources possible to be of assistance if that became a reality. That's just my feeling on that.
And the other thing I want to add, too, planning and development has been involved in these discussions as well, and Jerry Moore has drafted a letter, has not been sent out yet, but has drafted a letter reaching out to the other mobile home parks within the county to inquire about availability. Are there empty mobile homes? Are there places here for individuals to move to that would continue to be a more affordable housing option for them? I agree with what Paul said in terms of moving any of those mobile homes in Crestview. I don't think that's probably the best option or even a viable option, but we will be reaching out to those other parks to see what availability they have for mobile homes that are already located in the respective parks.
What kind of time frame do you foresee the Board of Health giving, assuming that he does not have a licensed operator monitoring the water quality on a daily basis? What kind of time frame do you think all of this is going to happen in?
You know, I don't really have a good feeling. And Margaret, maybe you can chime in if you'd like. I don't think it's reasonable to give him a week or 10 days. I mean,
no, I think 60 days is post the notice immediately,
right,
and then constantly be checking on his progress,
okay,
and then 60 days, boom.
So 60 days.
60 days, and I think I would make that recommendation to the Board of Health that we allow him 60 days. That's what he asked for at the Board of Health last week. So I would assume that would be the that'll be my recommendation to the Board of Health, that we give them 60 days.
Okay. So what I'm visualizing here is we need direction to staff so that they can begin preparing if, in fact, we are going to go through this. And so I see two parallel tracks that this is run on. The first one is dealing with the 31 family units. And, again, a family unit could be one, but dealing with the 31 family units that are out there right now. I'm happy to hear that there are resources available in the area. I would say that we, county staff, ought to be the facilitators of making sure that these family units are aware of those out there. So that involves outreach to these 31 family units. Then, Carly, it would involve your staff doing what you do, right, putting them in touch with where the resources are available. I would suggest that this board is going to want to allocate some direct dollar assistance available through community services to assist these family units in relocating. Off the top of my head, what I'm thinking is that Story County should be the secondary funder, so we ought to exhaust every other available resource, but then have a pool of dollars, and in my mind I'm thinking of $1,000 per family unit, up to $1,000 per family unit to assist with these kind of things, and run all that through Carla. But I don't want Carla to have the same restrictions as she currently has. So in my mind, the requirement for these family units to access the services from Carla would be that they are a current resident at this mobile home park, and that be it. And we're dealing with these 31 on the face of them. Wayne, you said it. I mean, this is a residence of last resort for many of these people. So I'm penciling all this out right now. So please don't take any of this as this is where I absolutely think we should be, but I think we need to be talking about it. So up to $31,000 there at the maximum $1,000 per one. And then the second line, and Stephen, I'm glad you walked in for this. The second line is disposal and cleanup of the area. We got to assume that if you guys, if the Board of Health issues this 60-day order, and we run the 60 days and this place closes down, we're not going to have a nice, clean area out there. It's going to be a mess, and it's going to fall to the county to clean it up. And so I think we ought to be prepared for that. But, Stephen, if the county spends public dollars to clean something like this up, I'm going to want to be able to put some kind of lien or something on that property so that ultimately the county has a chance, the people of Story County have a chance to get the money back that they put in, but we don't just let it sit there. So that's the two tracks that I'm on right now, and I throw it out there to you to see if you think I'm way off or I'm close.
No, I think you're on the right track, and I was going to bring this up, that the other thing that the board needs to keep in mind is that no matter what he does, I'm confident that there will be a number of abandoned trailers out there. Mr. Lemire claims he does not own any of those trailers, that the residents own them or they're renting to own them. And my thought is that most of the residents are going to move from that court, will simply pack their stuff and move, and the mobile home will remain.
Right, but then it becomes, I believe, it becomes some kind of junkyard, right? If we've got an abandoned trailer,
right,
is a junkyard, and between Margaret and Jerry,
yeah,
we've got to be able to, and Steve, in your office, we've got to be able to deal with that, and as the owner of the property, he's got some responsibility, even if he doesn't own the trailer.
Correct. Yep. And that was our conversation with, when he came in to see me here a couple of weeks ago, and we had a nice conversation with I try to get him to focus on the water. I told him, Brant, I said, when you eat an elephant, you do it one bite at a time. So let's concentrate on the water issues first, and we'll take what comes as it comes. So I think this gives us some good direction. Margaret, I'm assuming you're going to check with him here this afternoon and see what the status is or the DNR. The unfortunate part about this is that the enforcement should come from the DNR. But I believe that the DNR field officers have to stand in line to get a number to see somebody from the Attorney General's office to take this enforcement action. And they've been sitting back waiting for the Board of Health to do something. So I don't think we can wait any longer. I think we've probably, waited long enough to make sure
that we're going to get something. And just for my peace of mind, Ethan from the County Attorney's office has been involved in this as we've been working through the process. So.
Yep.
Okay, so we're on sound clean there. Carla, do you have enough information coming out of here to be able to formulate a plan? If the board were to allocate those kind of funds and take some of those restrictions off of you, would you be able to hit the ground running if we start seeing some of these family units?
Yeah, I think so. One thought I have is individuals may move out of Story County, so would we still consider helping those folks relocate to a new county? Is there any... Okay.
So I'd love for these people to stay in Story County, but that's not my concern right now. My concern is we're telling them they can't continue to live where they're living, and we don't want to just turn people out on the street
right.
with nothing. And so at least what I'm proposing would not be contingent upon them staying in Story County. This has everything to do with where they live today.
Okay. Yep. Thank you. Yep, that helps.
And part of it, I think... Part of the challenge is going to be proving whether they're actually a resident. I'm assuming there's some residents out there that have somebody sleeping on a couch in a very transitional mode. So it's anybody's guess on how many applications we'll actually see. So.
Well, and I'm capping it at 31. You told me that there's 31 occupied trailers out there. In my mind, that's 31
right.
maximum,
right.
31 applications.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Do you want us to pursue emergency funding through
I don't. I mean, we're talking about...
We I think Lisa would just love to see that, because I saw her say, oh, wait a minute. That's a matter of last resort.
You say it's limited funding.
It's limited funding, and it is...
very time
my recommendation that there's capacity in the county budget.
Yeah.
To accomplish this amount.
That's not good.
That's
there.
Not
we
a road
to.
We need to go right. down.
Right. I agree.
Yeah. All right. Okay. Anything else on this topic?
No.
I'm sure we'll hear about it again. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. So we'll adjourn for just a minute. We will. Are you ready? Okay. We'll go ahead and reconvene.
I think I have all
discussion consideration of adding 3 detention officer positions within the Story County Jail. John Officer, Mike Anderson, Lisa Markley, and George Dahls, anybody else? Okay.
So I guess we're just meeting back with you for the get there. We had Lisa crunch numbers, so I guess what you came.
Yeah, I'll talk about the numbers.
Yeah. So remind me where we left that. A month ago you came, you asked for the addition, you showed us the numbers, and I think at that point we asked you to go analyze what kind of overtime you'd actually use, what the offsetting cost would be. I think that's what we were talking about. Mm-hmm.
Again, my recollection is you set us out to work with her on where the money could come from to fund those additional positions.
Yep. What the net impact
would right. be. Right, and what the impact of the total budget would be.
Yep.
And I have numbers, but I really can't give you an impact because it's a crapshoot as far as I'm concerned. Average overtime wages for the last 3 years for that department is $66,200. That's for full fiscal years. FY16, as of the time I did this, which was shortly after they were here, we were at 86.6.
Okay.
So we're 20,000 ahead, and we're not done with the fiscal year. Number of overtime hours, the average for the last 3 years was 1,700. This year we're at 2,278, which is up about 1.5 times from 14. Comp time earned, again, up. Average, 3-year average is 458. We're at 702, which is about 2 times the last actual 14. FMLA used is the impacting factor, however, and that's something that nobody in this room is going to be able to predict. Our average 3-year, the 3-year average for FMLA use was 540 hours. This year we're at 1,457. Okay, which has a direct impact, as they were talking about, as the staffing. Putting 3 new detention officers, I don't know how that's going to impact your overtime. You're still going to have overtime, I think. The cost that Connie put together to begin with for what it costs to put on a detention officer, I totally agree with her numbers. So we're talking... For next year, for FY17, it'd be about to start them out 68.6, and that's to get them going. So that would be an additional, 68 per person.
Times 3, then.
Correct.
Okay.
That's what the request is.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we put the budget together for next year, we put it together with a certain number of positions, but we still didn't fund 100% of the salaries, knowing full well that when amendment time came, we would put in the additional dollars for actual costs. So, to me, that's a decision you make as far as if we're going to fund it, we know we're going to have to amend more in at the end of next year.
Mm-hmm. And now help me... John, you guys are not asking to increase the number of staff on any given shift. You're just asking to increase the number of people that are available to work those shifts. Or were you asking to increase the level of staff?
What we wanted to do was basically the 3 people, there's right now there is a small rotation on each shift. So basically there's one rotation that there's only 2 officers that are part of that rotation. To get that to where there's 3 people rotations on every shift. So that way, and that's basically one person would go to first, one would go to seconds, and one would go to thirds, and that would take the brunt of...
Absolutely, but on a day-to-day basis, you're not talking about changing the number of staff that you have
working. Correct. Yeah, just taking that load off of them being when they're so overworked right now and being just beat down, basically. Mm-hmm.
I can certainly understand that just forcing a staff member or entire staff to work overtime has more implications than just budgetary. You guys talked about concerns about staff being burned out, forced to work a 12-hour shift. I think your command staff would be able to are on 12s now anyway, but it's a little bit different when you're not expecting to have to work at 12 and you get told, hey, you're going to have to stay after split a shift because somebody's going over short staff. For me, I think there's a need to increase the staff. I just don't know what the right number is. You ask for three. I think if we approved one, I don't think that would make much impact on your staff.
The dilemma with adding one person or two people, say if you work first shift, you work second shift, you work third shift, I ask who needs help, you all raise your hands.
Right.
Where do I put that person?
Right. So that's the part I struggle with is the magic number. Right. And that's why the sheriff selected the sheriff, because it's his department and he makes those, determinations and it's our responsibility to fund those decisions that the sheriff made. So I'm looking for input. I mean, I don't think that just approving one position is going to make matters a lot better. You could see some improvement, but I don't think you're going to see the improvement that you're looking for.
Right.
Well, yeah. So for me, I struggle to get to three, and so for me, I walked in here today after the presentation a month ago when you guys were here. It became obvious to me that we needed to increase staff out there. And I get that three shifts, increasing by three, makes a lot of sense. It sure makes it easy. I'm not all that worried about easy. I'm worried about trying to make the bottom line figure pencil out. Lisa just told us that our average over the last, I think you said, 3 years was 1,700 hours a year of overtime, paid overtime, and we're at 2,200, almost 2,300 already this year. So that, and if you accept the numbers that you guys put together, where for every full-time position we actually are getting 1,500 hours of work because the rest of their year, the rest of their time is spent in training or doing different things, then that tells me that we are substantially over one position. But it's hard for me to look at the 2,278, which is going to go to 26 or 2,700 probably by the end of the fiscal year, and say, well, that's three positions, right? Because that's 4,500 more man hours, more person hours, I guess. So I'm set on one. I can probably be convinced of two. You're going to have a hard time getting me all the way to three. Talk to me a little about the ratios of male to female. We're really interested in having more female detention officers.
Correct. We want to go up to having 12 that we would have instead of the 9. So that would give us 4 on each shift.
So you're talking about all three of these positions you're requesting would be filled by females. So I'm going to just suggest that we move to 2 today. Approve 2 new positions today, and then come back and reanalyze this when we get to budget time for next year. And if we should have some good hard numbers from the first 4 or 5 months of FY17, and we can take a look and see where we are. I would challenge you guys. I'm counting on this having some impact. I understand we're not going to pay for it dollar for dollar out of overtime, but it should have some impact on what our overtime hours look like. Because if it doesn't, then we're just throwing money at a problem and not making any impact.
And
so
this starts at the beginning of July.
I see it, even if they advertise now, by the time they get somebody on board and going, we're in July, and so I don't want to hamstring them. If they can get somebody going sooner rather than later, I think that just benefits us.
trying to look at the timetable for when two people could come on board. And but then you say this time, budget time, are you saying that you would not make a determination until January of next year?
For the third position.
For the third position.
Yep. Okay. That, I'm suggesting two now. We let them go and try to fill those two positions and get them going as soon as possible. But then we make no commitments at all about that third position. We come back and talk about it at budget time.
I know she has something to say.
Really? I knew she should have started there.
Right?
I think they need you over there.
I'm sure these guys are saying she's going to talk. Oh, no.
I do want you to know you're talking about recruiting. We do have a list now that is valid for 2 years. So we do have people that I could go and make a phone call today and give them a conditional.
And what kind of timeline is there before they're ready to actually step in and start working?
It usually takes, and I'm going to consider their 2 weeks notice that they would give to their current employer. It can take about 3 to 4 weeks. And that's because we have to have them do the physical test, the MMPI. We have them do testing, and then they come back. So with appointments, 2 weeks, you're looking at 3 to 4 weeks.
Yeah, so what I think I would prefer, if this were to get approved, I'd prefer that you stagger the two positions, go ahead and get one on board going as quick as possible, and have the second one plan on getting them going about July 1st, about the time we hit the new fiscal year, and then we have the conversation again on budget time as to whether we're doing any more.
And I just wanted you to know that it would be sooner than later because we already do have the list.
Yeah. No. Yeah, so then I would say one sooner.
Right. So. Okay. That sounds like a workable plan.
That sounds like everybody on board.
Like John and
we're going to need a motion because it is a consideration.
Yeah, so I'll make the motion. I'll make the motion that we add two positions, one of them as soon as you guys can get filled, the other one not to begin before July 1st. That's my motion.
Second.
Got a motion and a second to approve two new positions at this point. One to start.
And do you have to specify what positions they are?
What's that?
The motion is
to add two female detention officers.
Detention officers.
Yeah. Perfect.
Okay.
Okay.
Shelly, you got that? All right.
I think you're Markley.
Okay. We've got our motion and a second. And to discuss anything further? Sanders.
Aye.
Clinton.
Aye.
Toot. Aye.
Can this be helpful to you guys?
I think so, yes. Thank you.
We're willing to listen for the third.
Gotcha.
Watch the overtime. I want to see that thing turn back down.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, no departmental or other reports. Public forum number two, comments from the public. If an item is not on the agenda, the board may not take any actions on the comments or the recommendations. No. Requirements of the open meeting law, but maybe so in the future. Anybody? Okay, liaison assignments,
meeting updates. Just very briefly yesterday, I met with Carl a little bit and we talked about a couple of the items that will come before the Regional Governance Board. We talked about the marketing position with Tridex and why that would be critical at this time. This will probably be mentioned more or less at the governance board, but part of this would be website development, crisis phone line to help with that, and well as the Hope Wellness Center trying to again get the word out as to the services that are available, and the recommendation that will come forth is that this would be a very needed service at this time. And then we also talked about the program manager. There was some discussion within the region about moving into this particular area. However, they are going to pull hold off on that at this time. They're going to revisit this. They did have a person in mind they thought was going to fill that, and that did not materialize. And because of the managed care providers and some of the other case managers' positions are not necessarily case managers, but there are
couple other people who might be able to assume some of these duties. So they're going to look at trying to reevaluate that and bring forth a recommendation at a later time regarding the program manager. But there is definitely a need for that service. They just don't know how it's best to fill it. There's just going to be some continual discussions regarding the service coordinator's position. As we know, that's in the jail. They are planning to post that, and this would be a person that would hopefully be housed in the community service building but would work in the jail each day and so forth. So you'll hear a little bit more about that position. I think that's scheduled to take place as of July 1st, but they've already made, I think that the sheriff is well aware of the ongoing discussions that we're talking about in this regard.
Super. Okay. Pass. I'll pass now to Wayne.
This Thursday, the Iowa Association of Counties and the Coast Guard Group is having their Smart Connection Conference at the Holiday Inn in West Des Moines that I'll be attending. We've got several people from my IT department that will also be there. It's geared primarily toward educating supervisors, working hand-in-hand, pairing up with some of the IT professionals from around the state as we look for some innovative changes and things of this nature. It should be a really an outstanding conference. Last time we had a presenter that really hit on cybersecurity and some of the little simple things that we need to be well aware of. And I think we will hear another presentation similar to what was shared with us in the past. So I will be attending that. And then on Friday, the ISAC Board of Directors meeting, I will be attending as well. So I'll just be gone on Thursday and Friday. Mm-hmm.
No meeting next Tuesday. Laura Serino, you guys get the day off.
Okay. I'm going to call you.
You're going to call me. We're doing it's a claims week, so I'll be sitting by the pool and we'll do claims over the phone.
And apparently, Leanne's going to add one thing to the consent agenda.
Yeah, and I'll be.
Is that a public hearing? Okay. All right. I'm always available on my cell phone, but over the next couple of weeks, I'm going to be probably out more than in because we're in the process of moving.
Anybody that's done that? Take a motion for adjournment.
Say it. I'll move.
I'll move. All right, we're adjourned. Thank you.
Oh, that's true.